I want to begin by just thanking the presenters who will be sharing Torah with us this evening, and also to thank Tradition for giving Rinat the opportunity to host this program. For those who have already received the Lamb Memorial Volume, they'll appreciate just how well done it is and how each of the writers for the volume are able to capture just one facet of a really a great man. And in introducing this book and launching the book this evening, I think it's worthwhile for us to reflect upon the holiday of Sukkot and Hoshana Rabbah that we are experiencing and celebrating now. Rabbi Lamb, in one of his drashot, I believe Meir Soloveitchik quotes in his article, talks about the etrog as being a symbol of Rabbi Lamb's ability to be doresh. And I would like to jump off that symbol that Rabbi Lamb himself evoked and speak about all the Arba meaning. And to describe a term that probably meant something very different when Rabbi Lamb was writing his drashot, but it has gained new meaning today with the internet. And that is the term evergreen, that Rabbi Lamb's drashot are things that, like an evergreen tree, are able to be verdant and beautiful in all seasons. And as we think about the various Arba meaning, and the meaning of Hoshana Rabbah and being able to celebrate such an ability to create hidur, to create hidur mitzvah, and to be a sense of connection to past and to future, but also to appreciate just how these works remain just as relevant now as when Rabbi Lamb first wrote them and first spoke them. And with that introduction, I'm going to turn out to Rabbi Jeff Sachs, who has pre-recorded a message for us. But again, please, just a reminder to please mute yourself as you come on so as not to interrupt the presenters.
Shalom and Chag Sameach. I'm Rabbi Jeffrey Sachs, the editor of Tradition. I'm sorry I can't join you in person in Teaneck for tonight's event, exploring the thought of Rabbi Norman Lamb and celebrating the memorial volume just published by Tradition. Before I share a few thoughts about the book, I wanted to congratulate you folks at Rinat on the selection of your new rabbi. In his other role, wearing his other hat, you know we have a timeshare on him. Rabbi Strauchler has proven to be an invaluable member of the leadership of our journal. I have come to rely on his good judgment, his calm demeanor, his warm friendship, as I'm sure you have as well. Chaim possesses an unusual constellation of talents, many of which reside at the intersection of intellect and ability, two things that don't always, and this bodes well for your community in the years to come. Since his passing last year, much has been said and written about Rabbi Lamb's life and legacy. Much more will surely be added in the years to come in evaluating his impact and enduring intellectual bequest. How could it be otherwise? Rabbi Lamb was another such figure who possessed a complex constellation of talents and filled a variety of roles in the life of our community. How many others could lay claim to a lasting legacy as a rabbi, preacher and teacher, scholar and writer, public intellectual and spokesman, thinker and philosopher, university president and Rosh HaYeshiva, and other roles as well? In our desire to assess this rich and multifarious person and his thought, we assembled the Rabbi Norman Lamb Memorial Volume as a special issue of Tradition, the Journal of Orthodox Jewish Thought, he founded in 1958. The 35 essays consider the monumental record of Rabbi Lamb's writings in fields as varied as the man himself, classical lumdus and Jewish philosophy, the interface of Torah and worldly wisdom, scholarship on Hasidism and the ideology and theology of its opponents, modern Orthodoxy's relationship with our brethren to the denominational right and left, faith, community, marriage, family, morality, education, the rabbinate, leadership, Israel, Zionism, and the Holocaust, then this is far, far from an exhaustive catalog. In the global public sphere, he tackled matters of interfaith relations and addressed the significance of Judaism's moral and philosophical teachings for civil and American constitutional law, and for contemporary science and even science fiction. His writings constitute the testament of a man teaching, preaching, and goading his own particular religious community, who also always looked outward, communicating a message to the wider world and encouraging us to do so as well. Perhaps more than anyone of his generation, Rabbi Lam viscerally believed in the power of thought and theory to animate action and practice. He was committed to the principle that modern orthodoxy would be strongest if its adherents tenaciously engaged the core ideas and philosophical foundations of our movement. And he saw his role as galvanizing his congregants, students, and friends and colleagues to join him in this endeavor, to talk, to debate, to argue. I think of my own arrival as a freshman entering Yeshiva College in 1987. At that time, Rabbi Lam had already been president for over a decade, and timed with YU's centenary, he embarked on conducting a conversation within the university and the larger American modern Orthodox community organized around the concept of Torah Umada. He made that motto resonate and inspire, using it as a lens to focus a process of deliberation and communal conversation about how to grapple with, make sense of, and organize our values around the confrontation and interaction of Judaism and Torah on the one hand, with secular studies and worldly civilization writ large on the other. Torah Umada, and the resulting book by that name, was perhaps the grandest example of his standing at the crossroads of thought and action between philosophy and lived religious community and commitment. But it was only one such example of many. I cannot exaggerate the personal importance of those ideas. To hear Rabbi Lam confidently proclaim, "We are no less human for our devotion to Torah and no less Jewish for our commitment to worldly wisdom," that was transformative. And it helped create a kind of permission structure for a young man such as myself finding his way into the world of committed Jewish life. With the goal of honoring Rabbi Lam as a thinker, scholar, philosopher, man of ideas, the memorial volume explores different areas of his legacy as expressed through his own writing. We asked our leading educators, thinkers, writers, and scholars to engage with the array of ideas with which he challenged us decade after decade. The reader will uncover a web of interconnected themes, passions, and concerns in moving among the book's offerings. Certain works are so central that it's not surprising to see them cited again and again in very diverse contexts. Some of our authors are among the many Lam family members who have gone on to make their own significant contributions to Jewish life and learning. And we hope that this volume adds a measure of comfort to them on the staggering double loss of Rabbi Lam just a few weeks after the passing of Mrs. Mindy Lam, Zichronam Livracha. We very deliberately avoided the pretense of the disconnected academic voice in our writing, which is, of course, never fully desirable or obtainable in all cases. These writers often telegraphed us how they have been profoundly challenged, personally inspired by Rabbi Lam.
This is a picture of Rabbi Lam.
In 1958, the 30-year-old Norman Lam inaugurated the pages of tradition by writing, "In our conception of tradition, we do not concentrate exclusively on the past at all. The word itself comes from the Latin tradere, which means to hand down, to transmit, to bequeath. Similarly, its Hebrew equivalent, Masora, derives from the root which means to give over. The focus of tradition is, then, the future and not the past. Tradition is thus a commitment by the past to the future, the promise of roots, the precondition of a healthy continuity of that which is worthy of being preserved, the affirmation that the human predicament in general and the Jewish situation in particular are not frighteningly new, but that they grow out of a soil which we can know and analyze and use to great benefit. We come after. We, today, live in a religious world transformed by those who came before, and by their ideas and vision. We and our children and our children's children are the bearers of the traditions so eloquently articulated, reasoned, and transmitted by Rabbi Norman Lamb and others. Ours is the future to which he committed himself. May we be worthy to carry on his mission and tradition for those who will follow.
We're going to turn now for our first live presentation. We're going to turn to Yoetzet Halacha Tova Warburg-Sinansky, one of Rabbi Lamb's grandchildren, who's going to speak about her grandfather under the title of Innovation Within Tradition. Yoetzet Halacha Sinansky, please.
Thank you so much, Rabbi Strachler, Rabbi Sachs, whenever you hear this, and to the Renot Adult Ed Committee and to the UF Initiative, which is spearheaded by Renot and a number of other shuls in the community. On a personal note, I had the opportunity to prepare for part of this on Sukkot, and I have a lot of memories, as I'm sure my family members who are here do as well, of being with my grandparents on Sukkot. And I actually tried to Zoom from the sukkah. It didn't work out so well with the lighting, but it was just very meaningful to be able to prepare for this with my grandfather's Sfarim outside in the sukkah, and many memories of learning together outdoors, whether it be in the sukkah or at Sackett Lake or at Camp Morasha. So thank you for this opportunity to learn about my grandfather's Torah and hopefully to share with you as well. In a 1971 Parshat HaChodesh drasha, which you should have in the chat, entitled Renewal, he utilizes the mitzvah of Kiddush HaChodesh, of counting the months, HaChodesh HaZalachem Rosh Chodeshim, as a way of addressing the perils of novelty. In classical rabbinical style, he had a mission and he found something in the parsha that connected. And this topic of the perils of novelty and the challenges that being obsessed with the new present is something that he turns to time and again in his writings. And he shares the insight of the Sfat Emet on the words HaChodesh Zalachem Rosh Chodeshim, who understands that this is not just a mitzvah to count the months, but it's also about something called Hitzchadshut, renewal. And he distinguishes my grandfather between Hitzchadshut, which is renewal, and Chiddush, which is novelty, on three different planes. And for the rest of the drasha, he basically focuses on the challenges of novelty, and being obsessed with the new from a more psychological perspective. And he calls for novelty in the service of higher values for Hitzchadshut. So a few examples, if you look at source number one, he writes, too often, the passion for Chiddush is a symptom of a spiritual malaise, of a threatening boredom, of an inner existential vacuum. People try to cover up the gaping and yawning chasm with their souls by a veneer of thrill-seeking novelty. The search for innovation is so often not a reaction to dissatisfaction with the old, as much as to dissatisfaction with the self. He also writes, I recently saw a cartoon in which I regard as significant. In it, we see Moshe holding the tablets as he comes down Mount Sinai, and a young man, remarkably hippie looking, says to him, redefine the commandments so as to make them more meaningful to the youth of today. And finally, in defining Hitzchadshut, he writes, renewal or Hitzchadshut aims not at the external world, but at the internal life, at the self, at the soul and the psyche, at character and personality. Hitchatshut aims at creating newness, not in the world of things, but in the world within. And I'd like to draw your attention to the end of this drasha, which was a little bit perplexing to me because I wasn't sure exactly what it added after he went through this whole exposition in beautiful language about the psychological challenges of novelty and what hitchatshut really means. And he writes, thus we find two opinions amongst the later Talmudic authorities as to the value of creative novelty, even in Talmudic learning. Chiddush, the realm of novella, or novel ideas and insights in the study of halacha, was looked upon critically by Rabbi Chaim of Volozhin, who felt that often the author of a chiddush will be so intoxicated with the pride of his discovery that it will lead him astray. And he goes on to talk about the challenges of coming up with what we call chidushei Torah, novel ideas in halacha. And then if you look down a few lines, he presents the opposing view. Against him stood that great Talmudist among Hasidic masters, the author of the Avnei Nezer, who welcomed the joy of Chiddush and who felt that the singular thrill of creative innovation in the world of intellect and Talmudic research was a positive good. Right, so he sets up that there's this debate within Jewish texts about the value of looking for novel ideas when we learn Torah. And what was so striking to me is after this whole exposition, which is very psychologically oriented and experientially oriented about hitchatshut, he then kind of seamlessly flows into this discussion of chidushei Torah, which really could be a separate topic, right? These two ideas of novelty in life in general and in our religious spiritual experiences and looking for novel ideas in Torah really could be two separate conversations that he really melds together. So what I'd like to do with you in our short time is to explore my grandfather's views on this type of chidush of looking at for novel ideas in Torah and see if we can gain some insights into his perspectives on that and hopefully at the end make sense of why he melds these two types of chidushim together. Chiddush, novel ideas in Torah, and hitchatshut. And if we come up with a chiddush, we'll have to see what the jury says about that after we learn about this topic. So we tend to take for granted the importance of offering chidushim. And I think this is especially true for someone like my grandfather, who was a close student of Rav Soloveitchik, and as we see, a highly innovative thinker in his own right. And when we attend Shiurim, we often, I know personally, want to come away with a new understanding of the topic. And sometimes if we know all the sources and we leave without some sort of earth-shattering chiddush, we leave disappointed. But if we take a step back, this whole notion of chiddush needs to be examined. If the goal of Torah learning is to search for truth, then you could make the claim that truth and chiddush kind of pull in opposite directions, right? Truth is we're trying to come to some sort of understanding, some sort of answer that's out there. And chiddush, as those of us who have the opportunity to learn and to, in various contexts, and to sort of delve into texts and try to come up with chidushim, is almost like an intellectual candy store with a treasure hunt with the goal of coming up with some new idea. So shouldn't truth be our focus and not chiddush, not novel ideas? So let's first address why coming up with chidushim is legitimate, why it might not be, and then, assuming that it is a legitimate endeavor, let's talk about why it's important. So to orient our conversation, there is one primary source, in source number 2 in Pirkei Avot, and we see this is a central debate that my grandfather actually brings up in his essay in 70 Faces, The Future of Creativity in Jewish Thought and Law, to orient the conversation. And the Mishnah tells us that there were 5 students that Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai had, and it lists all of them. And it highlights the qualities of 2 of the students. So Rabbi Lezer ben Horkanas, Bor Sod She'eno Me'abei Tiba. Rabbi Lezer ben Horkanas was a plastered cistern who did not lose a drop. So he basically learned something and he was able to retain it in its original form and then spit it back out, transmit it. And then Rabbi Elazar ben Arach, Mayan Mitgaber. So another student, Rabbi Elazar ben Arach, he was a spring that would just constantly flow and overflow with new concepts and ideas and was just exploding. And Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, the Mishnah says, Hu haya omer, im hiyu kol chachmei Yisrael bakaf moznayim, if all of the sages of Israel were on a balancing scale, Ba'elazar ben Horkanas bakaf shnia, and Rabbi Elazar ben Horkanas was on the other side, machriyat kulam, he would outweigh the rest of them. So it seems that according to Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, the preferable method is for someone to just take everything in and to hold it and protect it, but not to be this overflowing Mayan Mitkaber, not to be constantly exploding with Chidushi Torah. However, we have a little bit of a disagreement about what Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai thinks, because Abashal reports a different position of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai about what's more important, holding the tradition or innovation. And the Mishnah continues, Abashal ha'omer mishmo, he quotes Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai saying, Im yu kol chachmei Yisrael b'chaf moznayim, if all of the sages of Israel were on this scale, Rabbi Elazar ben Horkanas af imahem, and even Rabbi Elazar ben Horkanas was with him on that side, Rabbi Elazar ben Arach b'chaf shinyan, and Rabbi Elazar ben Arach was on the other side, machriyat kulam, that he would outweigh the rest of them. So really what's preferable is novelty. And to complicate it further, we have a Gemara in Sukkah and in a parallel Gemara in Bracha, which records that Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai himself would never say anything without quoting his teacher. So it's really unclear as to what he thinks. I think there are different ways of resolving these sources, but this is really a fundamental source about this topic. And clearly this debate about Chidushi Torah is not something that started in the 21st century. This is something that's been predates us. And this is really a central source. So in my grandfather's various writings, he elaborates a number of concerns about saying Chidushim, and perhaps, you know, starts off siding with the characteristic of Elazar ben Horkanas of Bor Sod She'inama Beitipat, that it's better to be someone who can just take it all in, retain it, and not come up with new ideas. And we already saw in source number one, some of the perils of coming up with Chidushim, just to sort of dive a little deeper. If you look back at source number one, so one of the highlights there was that Rav Chaim Volozhin felt that the problem is that if you are so involved in looking for Chidushim, you get so excited about the discovery process that it will lead you away from truth. And you'll just be looking for more evidence to sort of substantiate your Chiddush. And therefore, he would actually try to counsel against Chidushim, and he stayed away from them because he wanted to make sure he stayed with the truth. He reiterates this again in this essay in 70 Faces, The Future of Creativity and Jewish Thought and Law, in that essay. And in a number of places in his writings, he cites the Gaon who opposes finding joy in Chidushim, lest one be led astray. In source number three, Torah Umada, footnote 33 from chapter one, he also talks about Rav Chaim. And he says he regarded the joy of creativeness as a form of bribe to distract him from the truth. So almost like putting it as like this, sort of personifying this idea of Chiddush as something negative. So the first concern that we see here is that Chiddush really can lead one astray because it's so exciting and it really sucks you in and it becomes the focus instead of truth. A second concern regarding Chidushim is that it can threaten the proper balance between independence and submission, which is obviously something that we deal with all the time as religious individuals. What's the proper stance toward our teachers, toward Torah sources, intellectual independence, and how does that all shake out? And he discusses this in Torah Lishma. If we look at source number four, he comments on the and the Mishnah in Pirkei Avot, v'havei mit'avik ba'afar raglayhem, that we're supposed to sit at the dust of their feet, and building off the pasuk in Bereshit, v'yevater Yaakov levado v'yevik ish imo arelot hashachar, in source number 5, he in the footnotes, offers a very beautiful explanation, which I think brings out one of the perils of chidushim, which is that he says that v'havei mitabek v'afar raglayhem, wrestle with the rabbis. If you look in the footnote 37, it also says v'afar raglayhem. So you're supposed to wrestle, but also ba'afar raglayhem, which he interprets to mean while acting in a humble manner and posture with you on the ground and they above, right? So clearly he struggled, Rav Chaim struggles with this tension and brings this out as a potential issue. How do we act with submission and humility toward those that are greater than us if we are looking for chidushim? So these are among some of the concerns he mentions in his writings, but he also, I would say, on the whole, champions chidushim and almost takes them as a given. If we look in source number 6 from Torah Umada, he outlines, kind of gives a primer on the, you know, how does Torah learning work at the beginning, and the very first few pages, and he says, it was the task of the master not only to give the lecture, which consisted of the pirush or explanation of the text on the page, but also to give chidushim, new comments, that is to formulate new insights and offer original explanations. So this is quite striking, definitional for him to how a Torah learning environment is set up, is that the teacher is not just supposed to explain the words on the page, but to offer some new insights, offer some chidushim, definitional to Torah study and to teaching. In source number 7, and in many of his Chag HaSmicha drashas, when he focuses heavily on Talmud Torah, something that everyone needs to continue to do, you can see from Notes of an Unrepentant Darshan, this is actually pretty interesting. I'm wondering what some of the rabbis here are going to think about this. Finally, both rabbis and congregants will have to understand that changes must be made in the scheduling of sermons. It is simply impossible to be creative on a weekly schedule. Neither babies nor rabbis respond well to nourishment by the clock. For the rabbi to see something significant, he must prepare, and that means learning and reading and thinking, as well as organizing and writing. And the burdens of being fresh and original every week is beyond the powers of most mortals. So I don't have any powers in this regard, but I thought that was a fascinating source where definitional to being rabbis is to offer chidushim. In source number 8, and this is something where we see he quotes the Sefer Chassidim many times in his writings. When talking to the Smicha graduates, he writes, and whatever specialty you pursue with Torah, I urge you to develop your ideas, and if worthy enough, publish them. Disseminating your chidushim is a great spur to your further study and creativity. And then he reminds us to always remember what the Sefer Chassidim says. Any new idea that comes to you is a divine revelation, and it was granted to you in order that you write it down and share it with others. If you fail to do so, you are in effect stealing from God. And not that I have any great chidushim to offer, but I do remember many times my grandfather, as I was learning these texts, I remember him telling me to write things down. And I know he clearly wrote things down. He had extensive filing method of writing down his ideas, but this is something that was really important to him. And finally, in source number 9, in another Chag HaSmicha drasha, he quotes the Sefer Chassidim, and then very interestingly, when he talks about sharing chidushim, he writes, and if this is true of Torah novella, which another Talmid Chacham may be able to disprove, how much more so is it true of creating Torah personalities, of making Jews who will live and support Torah? So it's interesting that he extends this idea of being Mechadish Torah, ideas in Torah, to creating Torah personalities, which we'll come back to shortly. So these are just a few of the many places where he makes a clear plug for chidushim. And the question I'd like to explore next is, why is chidush so important to him? And the first reason is suggested by a number of sources in Torah Lishma where he is talking about Rav Chaim and the Gaon. So if you look in the second paragraph, the words he maintains, so he writes, he maintains, and he's talking about Rav Chaim, that his custom is to follow his own ideas. If he finds some other author opposed to them, he neither abandons his opinions, nor does he immediately dispute that author. Instead, he relies upon the objective reader who seeks the truth to determine which opinion is correct. For when it comes to Torah, which is called truth, we look only for truth. And then he thanks God that men's opinions are not identical. Here he's quoting the Chut HaMeshulash. And both these and these are the words of the living God. Elu ve'elu divrei Elokim Chaim, provide that he direct our hearts to render a decision that accords with the truth of Torah. And he, blessed be he, for the sake of his seal of truth, may he open our eyes to find the ways of truth in the Torah, which is called truth. So he clearly advises a strong intellectual, I would say, provides a lot of permission for people to be intellectually independent. And finally, if you look to the fourth line from the bottom, it is forbidden for a student to accept his teacher's words if he finds them deficient, for at a time, the truth is with the students. And then he goes on to talk about what happens if you disagree with the teacher. So he clearly shows how Rav Chaim advocated for this intellectual independence. And my grandfather himself also does in numerous places. One example in source number 11, he ends his essay about the future of creativity in Jewish thought and law, which is partially about the topic of chidush and novelty, with a story that I actually heard from someone else originally. I conclude with an illuminating story. My distinguished colleague, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein Zatzal, the Rosh Yeshiva of Har Tzion, as well as Yeshiva University's Gross Institute, was present when once the Rav, his father-in-law, gave a shiur. He was scintillating. His chidushim were absolutely brilliant. There was one stranger in the audience who was taken aback at the Rav's intellectual audacity and said to him after the lecture, "But Rabbi Soloveitchik, what is your source?" The Rav answered, "A clear and logical mind." Right? So this is something that I heard many times from my grandfather. So I think the above text that we've seen reveal that my grandfather believed, well, you could pin truth and innovation as opposites. You really can also view this from a different perspective that kind of collapses this distinction. And I think what he's saying is that in order to access the truth within our tradition, innovation is a requirement because truth is found in many places, right? It's not just found on high, but it's found through the process of learning and being actively involved in Torah study in a very deep way. And Hashem is constantly revealing himself to us through this process. So to receive the revelation almost, we must play an active role. And this is basically, Rabbi Yehuda Chassid basically says, chidushim don't belong to you, they belong to God, right? Because they are part of God's revelation. We are just the shaliach. So we have no right to withhold chidushim. So I think that's the first reason my grandfather felt that chidushim were very important. A second reason, I think, is part of his philosophy that he adopted from Rav Soloveitchik and also from Rav Tzadok HaKohen of Lublin about this idea of partnering with God in creation. And just to refresh very, very briefly, Halachic Man in source number 12, Halachic Man is a man who longs to create, to bring into being something new, something original. And he writes, the study of Torah by definition means gleaning new creative insights from the Torah, Chidushi Torah. The Holy One, blessed be he, rejoices in the dialectics of Torah, a popular folk saying, read not here dialectic pilpul, but rather Chiddush. The dream of creation is the central idea in the halacha consciousness, the idea of the importance of man as a partner of the Almighty in the act of creation. And then he writes about, what do we have to learn from the story of creation? He says the Torah spoke about the creation of the world for a reason, not to reveal cosmogenic secrets and metaphysical mysteries. If the Torah then chose to relate to man the tale of creation, we may clearly derive one law from this manner of procedure, which is that we are supposed to be involved by a Torah learning in the act of creation. He echoes this, this idea that Rav Soloveitchik writes about extensively, very beautifully in his introduction to Halachos V'Halichos, which is his sefer on halachic topics in the introduction. And in talking about the shiurim of Rav Soloveitchik, he writes, Hayu b'shiurav v'shash l'tamidav b'riyah yesh me'ayin. Right, and he even invokes this creation language, right, that the Rav Soloveitchik shiurim, which he writes were so influential on him, were these creations from nothing. At first it was tohu vavohu, right, like the words of before Hashem created the world, barak mitoch ha-tohu vavohu, from nothingness and all this chaos, yatzu briyot, briyot shel kayama, then life arose. And this idea of creation, I think, might also explain his comment earlier in the Chag HaSmicha Drasha, the spirit of Elisha rests upon Elijah, it was one of the earlier sources, in which he talks about impacting other Jews. And I think the underlying assumption is that the common thread between learning Chidushi Torah and sort of impacting other Jewish people is this idea of creation and is partnering with God to sort of create on both of these planes. So to understand his second motivation for the importance of Chidushim, I think that if you view this tension between innovation and tradition, we also see a distinction collapse. Hashem did not bring us into this world, says Rav Soloveitchik, my grandfather, to just observe and take everything in and just look at the cosmos and be amazed. That's wonderful and that's true, but rather part of being a human being and part of being a Jewish human being is also to create, to build, and to innovate. So halachic Jewish living actually requires innovation. It's not in conflict with tradition, but tradition actually requires innovation. That's what it means to be part of the Jewish tradition. And finally, a third reason that my grandfather believed that chidushim are important, and I want to thank my husband's feet for pointing this out to me, is because and you can be medayik in one of the sources, A Rabbi Inside and Out, which is an earlier source, is that he writes, whatever specialty you pursue within Torah, I urge you to develop your ideas. And he writes, disseminating your chidushim is a great spur to your further study and creativity. So I think part of his emphasis and his plug for chidushim really connects to the ways in which Torah study can feed into feeling spiritually vibrant overall. And here we see, again, this collapsing between not between tradition and innovation, but between these two types of novelty, right, in Torah learning and in religious experience. So you could view Torah learning, chidushim, innovation within Torah on one track, and you could view this idea of hitchadshut and spiritual renewal on another track. But what I think he's saying is that they're really one and the same. Torah learning and chidushim lead into self-growth and to hitchadshut. So to summarize, we opened up with his drasha called renewal, and I posed the question, why does he kind of meld together two ideas that could be distinct? The question of the legitimacy of Chidushei Torah, which he ends with, and this idea of Hitchadshut, aren't they separate topics, which they really could be. We looked at a primary source on the search for novelty and Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, and we were left kind of unclear about that source. And then we explored a few reasons that one might be suspect about Chiddush, and then looked at a number of indications for how my grandfather really very much promoted Chidushim and some of the reasons to support. So I wanna see if we can now come back and answer why my grandfather moved seamlessly between his discussion of Hitchadshut, renewal in religious life, and Chidushei Torah. And I believe he does this because in his mind, as we've seen, innovating and being steadfast to tradition in all realms, right, in the realm of sharing Chidushim and the realm of spiritual renewal are not at odds with each other at all, but they really are one and the same. To be a traditional Jew is to be an innovator. And if you look in source number 14, another one of his drashot about the perils of novelty, he basically puts it out there and says, this is really a human question that we have to contend with. How can and does Judaism respond to this challenge? It will not do merely to condemn it. It is an innate feeling, and I suspect a deeply rooted part of the human psyche. You cannot banish the desire for change and newness merely by denouncing it. Yet you obviously can't submit to it. So what then? And his answer is very telling, which is, we are always to combine the old and the new, to find new insights in the old and relate the new to the permanent and unchanging. And he ends off by saying the last three lines here, if we fail to strive for chiddush, for the element of newness in all realms, in Torah learning, in our spiritual lives, in our inner experiential lives, then we are at the mercy of boredom, the horror of that same old thing, and that is the death of the spirit. So we must innovate within tradition. That's built into what it means to be traditional in order to not succumb to the death of the spirit, which obviously would be something that is not at all of our goal, but really the worst thing that could happen. And that's why I think he moves seamlessly between these two types of tradition. And I'd like to end off in the source number 15, as he ends off his drasha on renewal with a statement from Rav Kook, where Rav Kook also basically, I think, suggests something very similar. And Rav Kook says, the major disease of this generation lies in this, that it considers it unnecessary to review and understand deeply matters which are old, which can under no circumstances be achieved. For the new is firmly established only when it derives from the source of the old, right? So innovation is positive only when it really comes from the old. As the rabbis put it, the true servant of the Lord is one who reviews his studies not 100, but 101 times. So I hope that we can all merit to really learn the lessons that my grandfather is striving to teach us here about what does it mean to be a traditional Jew? And I think it does mean to innovate within tradition. Thank you.
Thank you, Tova. And we're going to have questions for both Tova and Tzvi after the conclusion of both presentations. I'm going to turn over now to Tzvi, who's going to be speaking about Lam, a monist for modern.
Thank you so much, Rabbi Israel Chalera. I just placed the source sheet in the chat. Hopefully everyone can have access from it there. I will also share my source sheet momentarily by sharing my screen. Give me one moment. Okay. Fantastic. All right. Hopefully everyone can see it in both directions. I certainly see people are able to access the link. One second. Thank you once again to Rabbi Strauchler, to Congregation Miran Yisrael, to the Tradition Journal, to Rabbi Sachs, to the Renowned Adult Ed Committee, as Tova said, to Feliendis in particular, to the Yoetzet Halacha Initiative, in Teaneck as well. It really is a tremendous honor and privilege to be here looking around the virtual room. I see so many family members, including my parents, who are joining as well, family members on Tova's side who have played such a formative role in my own life, not only themselves, but also in helping to amplify so many of the messages that Rabbi Lem himself embodied, even more than he preached, but simply lived. And that's really the way in which I was fortunate to be exposed to Rabbi Lem. I must confess that it is always difficult to follow my wife in any circumstance. It's certainly a difficult act to follow, especially after a presentation like this. I would add as well that someone who had read both my article as well as that of Tova in the new volume, in the Tradition volume, someone pointed out, remarked to me and said, you know, Tzvi, your piece was a very nice piece, a very thoughtful piece, really an outstanding piece among the many in the volume, but there was one that clearly stood out head and shoulders as better than yours, and that was that of your wife. I am doubly humbled to be speaking in this context and to follow Tova. But I will say as follows before jumping in, I am stirred, especially hearing Tova cite Pirkei Avot and a number of other texts that bring me back to our Charuta, Tova and my Charuta with Rabbi Lem from 2005 to 2007 in his office in First Hall and Yeshiva University. And we used to go up once a week and select a different text and go up and we'd learn together. And exactly Tova's theme of finding innovation within tradition, it was extraordinary. Here we were learning, for example, Pirkei Avos, Ramesh HaChachma, other topics, even parts of Nefesh HaChayim, which was quite humbling given Rabbi Lam's unique expertise, of course, in the thought and life of the Chaim of Lajin, as Tova said. Here we were, and Rabbi Lam would pull out Chassidish Rebbe's enlightened, almost Haskalah-esque tracts on Pirkei Avot, volumes that no one else had seen and studied, and he would pull them out, and they just became part of our own canon, part of our own study. And so this notion of innovation within tradition really resonates so deeply, I think is a powerful stir to many memories, inspiring ones in its own right. At the same time, this memory of Rabbi Lam pulling out this incredibly eclectic set of sources from his bookshelf, and his bookshelves were nothing if not brilliantly eclectic, I think speaks to one of the most remarkable facets of Rabbi Lam's thought, and it's one that I'd like to examine a little bit and to reconsider. Rabbi Sacks, or Jeffrey Sacks, mentioned in his introductory comments, the perhaps the most remarkable about Rabbi Lam's output is not just the ways in which it's prolific, but again, the wide range, the variation, the variegated sources and texts that he quotes from Halacha, from Midrash, from Kabbalah, from Chassidus, from Tanakh, from Mefarshim, from Midrashim, you name it. He was drawing from all over to create this incredible tapestry. And if you take a look at the source sheet, I believe I noticed earlier that he was on with us as well, Dr. David Schatz, in his Introduction to Festivals of Faith, a collection of the various sermons, or of a number of sermons on the holidays. And he writes as follows in the introduction, "Variety is the hallmark of this collection. As the index reveals, the nearly 320 traditional texts that Rabbi Lam quotes, only 18 appear in more than one sermon, usually for different purposes and with different interpretations. And only one quoted text appears in more than two sermons. In addition, if one were to formulate the main moral of each sermon in the Musar Haskel, one would realize that virtually every sermon has a fresh message. Thus, while obviously some themes recur and there's a consistency of orientation in almost every presentation, Rabbi Lam provides novelty, chidush, as regards both text and message. And I believe that what Dr. Schatz suggests or comments with regard to this particular collection of sermons is true not only for the sermon collection, all 800 of them as a whole, but also really for all of Rabbi Lam's thought. If we just look at his output, we look at the not just the drashos, but the sheer variety of texts, a textbook essentially on an incredibly thick and one of the most robust and still outstanding English language textbooks on Chassidus, to his some have argued at least his magnum opus, certainly his most direct statement of his philosophy with regard to Torah Umada in the book by that name, to Halachos V'Halichos that Tova mentioned earlier, which is really an incorporation of Agadah together with Halacha, to so many other sources and texts. To take a look at his book, the Shema, the sheer gamut of texts that he was quoting from and with which he had tremendous facility and even expertise was just stunning. I even mentioned the medieval Rishonim that he had expertise in, just simply extraordinary and truly remarkable. And so one is struck immediately, whether it's reading some 35 essays on just different facets of Rabbi Lam's thought in the new volume, whether it's simply reading or just examining the various titles of the of different works that that he published, both during his lifetime and have been collected even beyond. The simple variety is really just extraordinary and truly stunning. And it raises a fundamental question, which is, well, is Rabbi Lam simply eclectic, or is there in fact a strand? Is there a central theme? Is there a motif that runs throughout? And at first glance, we might say that's absurd, it's ridiculous. How could it be that someone who examined all of the major contemporary issues for the second half of the 20th century through such a broad canon of texts was somehow had some unifying set of either texts or ideas that were ran through or the leitmotif that stood at the core of his ideas? And yet what I'd like to suggest this evening is that ironically, perhaps it's precisely through that eclecticism that actually perhaps we see one of the most central themes. I think it's one that Rabbi Lam made explicit, but I think it's one that's well worth amplifying and elaborating this evening. And that is indeed based perhaps to go all the way back to 1961, just a few short years after having founded the Journal of Tradition. Rabbi Lam wrote an article entitled The Unity Theme and Its Implication for Moderns. And this appears in source number 2 in the source sheets. And he opens as follows, and it's a remarkable piece, which I strongly recommend. It's essentially republished in Faith and Doubt with some additions in his responses to his rabbinic colleague and interlocutor, Rabbi Dr. Walter Wurzberger, who objected to some of the elements of the article, and Rabbi Lam with a tremendous grace and respect and diplomacy, as always, both recognizes and appreciates Rabbi Wurzberger's comments and yet responds firmly in kind in defense of his own position. And Rabbi Lam opens his initial article as follows. He says, "The oneness of God is universally acknowledged as the foundation stone of Judaism and its main contribution to the world. The theme of the Shema, 'Hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one,' underlies every single aspect of Jewish life and thought, and permeates every page of its vast literature." And here's the kicker. Rabbi Lam adds, "So powerful is this vision of God's unity that inevitably it must express the corollary that the divine unity is the source of a unity that encompasses all existence." And this is a remarkable statement. Right? So, for example, when we say in Aleinu, right, that in od milvado, based on the pasuk in Parshat Ve'etzchanan, the question is, what exactly does that mean? And here he's drawing very clearly on sources such as the Nefesh HaChayim and the Tanya at once in the question as to how we understand God's presence in this world. And I'm not going to label this as the debate between Rav Chaim of Volozhin and Rav Shneur Zalman of Liadi. The Baal HaTanya, as some do, because Rav Elam himself is not entirely certain that that's an accurate portrayal of this debate. But nonetheless, it certainly harkens back to a fundamental question with regard to the nature of God's transcendence. And it's exactly this issue. On the one hand, we have one classic conception, which seems to be certainly the one that emerges most naturally from Maimonidean philosophy and other thinkers, if we take them certainly at face value, and that is to insist upon a full and radical sense of transcendence and absolutely irrevocable divide between humanity and all else of existence and divinity and God himself. And yet, by contrast, the classic for Rabbi Lem in particular, Hasidic notion, Kabbalistic notion, and as we'll see as well, Cookian notion, Rav Cook, the original Rav Cook, Rav Avram, Rav Yitzchak, and this idea that there might be an alternative, which Rabbi Lam was particularly attracted toward, which is this notion that no, melochol aretz kivodo, as appears in countless texts in the early Hasidic literature, that somehow God's presence manifests all of existence. Now, in his introduction to the book on Hasidism and in a number of other contexts, and I heard him say this on numerous occasions, Rabbi Lam was very, very clear to distinguish between what we call pantheism on the one hand and panentheism on the other. He introduced me to this term, panentheism. And what he meant by this is that a pantheistic view would probably be a Spinozan view, which he viewed as absolutely heretical and an unacceptable Jewish perspective, which is to equate fully between the natural world and divinity. And that he rejected. There are those who have tried to read Spinoza in other ways, but that's for a different time. He certainly did not in any case. And that was the pantheistic worldview. And by contrast, the panentheistic worldview, which he ascribed to the Zohar, to major strands of Kabbalah, Hasidut, of Kook, etc., maintained that there is no identity between God and the universe. But there is an overlap in the sense that God encompasses, but at the same time transcends and goes beyond all of physical existence. Somehow on some level, yes, melochol haaretz kivodo, but God's presence does not stop there. It is both not just physically, of course, but conceptually, theoretically, it is beyond all of material and physical existence. So that somehow we are all encompassed within that great embrace of divinity, and yet at the same time, that is not the sum total. It's not pantheism, it is rather panentheism. And Rabbi Lam believes that this was a very attractive perspective. He was always certainly respectful of different approaches within the Jewish tradition, even on Torah Umada. While he was the great champion of Torah Umada, he made space in the spirit of Elu Ve'elu Divrei Elokim Chayim for what he called the Torah only approach, even as he firmly disagreed, but nonetheless maintained that this was Torah only was a legitimate theoretical position within the larger constellation of Jewish perspectives, but just simply like any other machlokes, one with which he disagreed. And here too, he recognized the possibility of the radical transcendence as certainly a legitimate and predominant view, or a predominant view among Jewish thinkers. Nonetheless, he was taken by, I would say, not just acknowledged or forwarded, but I think was very much enchanted by this notion. And he continued in the second paragraph of that essay in source number 2, nowhere is the idea of Yichud Hashem, the unity of God, given more poignant and intense expression than in the Kabbalah. In Jewish mysticism, the unity of God is not only one of the mightiest themes, it becomes a living reality, perhaps the only reality. God's unity is taken not alone as an arithmetic proposition, but as the unification of all existence in all its awesome diversity through God. It is symbolized in the Kabbalah by the unity within God himself. It is this unity elaborated, explained, enhanced, and expounded by Kabbalists from the Zohar through the late Rav Kook, of which our modern world stands in such desperate need. And here he comes to the question of why this was so attractive to him. And one of the reasons, in addition to his own theological grounding, his own familial grounding, his own Hasidic background and that element of his educational background, but in addition, it was in response to his sense of the atomization of the modern world. And this is as so many other areas. Here he's writing in 1961, as just has been remarked with regard to the sermons, how prescient they were and how relevant a sermon from the 1960s continues to be in 2021. How relevant are these words some 60 years later? If it was ever necessary to reaffirm that theme with his conscious rejection of all conflict, multiplicity, and fragmentation, it is today when mankind stands poised, ready to blow itself to bits, both physically and conceptually. So he's speaking about the atomic age, but he understands that it goes far beyond that. And he entitles a subsequent section in the same essay, Disintegration. And this is really what he sees and observes so uncannily about the DNA of modern man. He says, modern man and the complex society he has built for himself are in a state of progressive inner disintegration. Psychologically, socially, and spiritually, he has reformed himself in the pattern of his new industrial economy with the obsolescence of the artisan who fashioned the whole vessel. The whole man has faded into obscurity. It's a fascinating piece, and you can certainly feel free to continue. He connects this to the division of labor, going back to previous centuries. Of course, he talks about specialization in professional life, which we know has only continued unabated until today. Culturally, the expert dominates. He speaks about literature, which is strive for the wholeness of man. Literary microscope has merely reacted to our inner atomization, put under the literary microscope man's baseness and degradation, and so on and so forth. He connects us to literary criticism. Speaking of Spinoza, at least as a precursor to that, he speaks of this philosophically, and then he concludes that man's spiritual and religious life has become a true world of disunity, what the Kabbalah calls an alma de piruda. Long before the atom bomb struck Hiroshima, the modern world sustained a historic atomization, the fission and disintegration of man's heart and soul and mind, and the beginning of the end of his universe. And so this becomes not only a theme that theologically is very attractive to Rabbi Lam and is very much rooted in his embrace of Kabbalah and Hasidus in many key aspects, and bringing that into as we'll speak about momentarily, into spaces where perhaps that was less familiar or less embraced back in the 1960s, for example. And he sees this also as fundamentally an elixir, certainly one of the essential elements in the cure of that which is ailing, of the malady of modern men. What's remarkable about Rabbi Lam is of course not only this idea. This is far from a chidush, if we want to use that terminology, in the sense of a brand new idea. He's of course rooting his thought in ideas that are ancient, that are traditional, that are classical. And yet I would suggest that he was unique in four respects. And we're going to focus on the fourth, but I think that they're all worth elaborating. First of all, in doing so, Rabbi Lam, in introducing these ideas of Kabbalah generally, and this particularly almost seemingly explosive theological concept, and nonetheless insisting that it actually provided a foundation for a profoundly traditional Jewish life, both at the time of the founding of Hasidus all the way until today. But Rabbi Lam was really introducing an idea that went against the grain. And this is the first thing that really, I think, stands out about his introduction of this this unity motif, this sense of this theological panentheism. He embraced this at a time when Hasidism was not necessarily in vogue in the way that it is today in the modern Orthodox community. Neo-Hasidism did not exist, at least as a term, even if we think that there are thinkers or precursors to this movement, but certainly in our community, quite the opposite was the case. The greatest claim that one could stake to authenticity in many, many modern Orthodox circles in the 1960s was that of rationalism, was that of intellectualism, and to introduce Kabbalah and Hasidus, and then to turn them on their heads and to argue that actually these are incredibly intellectually sophisticated and compelling ideas. This itself was a novelty. And as he comments in Torah Umada, he says it might not necessarily be that which one would have expected for one at that time, at the time that he was active, for this to be presented, for Hasidic ideas to be presented as a foundation for Torah Umada. And at that time, for many of the ideas of Yeshiva University, I think it's fair to say, as well. And so, consistent with that sense of intellectual independence, he was uncowed, he was unafraid, he was in many ways actually quite ahead of the curve. In fact, one of the essays in the collection actually just simply makes the observation, not attributing to Rabbi Lam any influence, but just simply observes that Rabbi Lam was very early to introduce Hasidic ideas. And if you go to the Yeshiva University campus today, you'll see many influences of cultural, of lived Hasidic experience in a variety of ways. And while we might not attribute these necessarily directly to Rabbi Lam, it's quite remarkable that he was so ahead of the curve and really just independent. He simply believed in these ideas. He thought that they were compelling and that they addressed so many of the issues that were underlying the challenges of our modern community. And so he was unafraid and unabashed to simply speak the truth as he saw it and to embrace and to promulgate those ideas. Number two, as I mentioned, not only did he go against the grain, but he gave this notion of monism, that everything is somehow incorporated or encompassed by the existence of divinity, a scholarly academic cast. Of course, Rabbi Lam was a scholar's scholar and a master not only of so many realms and rooms of knowledge and books, but also someone who was deeply committed to academic accuracy and to truth. His book on Nefesh HaChaim, his dissertation, became an extremely influential and very important, even pivotal work on Rav Chaim and on Rav Chaim's response to Hasidus. And the inherent value of study, of learning, was obviously, and learning and finding truth in particular, was of course one of the central motifs of not only Rabbi Lam's thought, but his essence, his kishkas. It was there. And so he gave these ideas, which might not have otherwise been respectable at that time, gave them a scholarly, even academic cast, simply because of who he was. He was able to contribute, I think, to the perception of respectability of many of these otherwise perhaps underappreciated ideas beyond the academy, where Gershom Shalom and others had begun to promulgate some of these and popularize some of these ideas, but certainly beyond the academy and even within, I think Rabbi Lam was actually quite important in this respect. Number three, he manages to embrace monism without being predictable or repetitious. So many thinkers might otherwise turn everything into another Jewish on, you know, Hashem is here, Hashem is there, Hashem is truly everywhere, which is, by the way, just as an aside, not just a song, but a very specific and intentional statement of not just Chabad theology, not just Uncle Moishe's Chabad theology, but actually goes to exactly this question. This notion of Melucha La'aretz Kevodo, but he managed to do so without simply sounding the same theme and motif again and again, and rather was incredibly, again, as said, broad in his presentation. And finally, I think that there are a series of implications which I'd like to take the opportunity to explore. And I think this is what was perhaps most remarkable about Rabbi Lam's invocation of this idea of what he called monism for moderns is really this idea, this notion that he applied this concept, which again had very deep roots in the literature that he was drawing on, and he applied it in novel, exciting, and profound ways, in ways that really, I think, really do run throughout his entire corpus, in ways that really, I think, stake a claim to this being perhaps the, or at least a central motif that is dominant and that is essential to a broader understanding, a fuller understanding of Rabbi Lam's thought as a whole. And I think we can frame it as follows. We know that the Gemara in Kiddushin, as well as elsewhere in Bava Kamma, poses the question, the conflict between Talmud and Ma'aseh, that there are these two central areas of Jewish life. There's learning and there's action. The Gemara even gives an apparently conflicted response, and there's tremendous discussion about these two poles, Talmud and Ma'aseh. And yet, without question, it's these two poles that are, in many ways, represent the totality of what it means to live our lives as full-fledged Jews, to integrate these two in our lives. And I think it's therefore very striking that if we look at Rabbi Lim's invocation and use of this notion of monism for moderns throughout his thought, I think we can see it both in context of Talmud, of learning, as well as in context of Ma'aseh and how we are meant to live within the world. I'll mention a few examples of this. First of all, with regard to learning, both with regard to content and with regard to method. In so many respects, content in terms of learning, and here I refer specifically to the notion of Torah Umada, what's striking in this regard is that for Rabbi Lam, if one reads Torah Umada, and it's even already here in the 1961 article, it becomes immediately clear that perhaps the most persuasive, compelling argument for Torah Umada in Rabbi Lam's mind is this notion that ultimately this milochol haaretz kivodo, this sense that God permeates all of existence, is precisely the most powerful, combustible in the best of ways, creative way that we can literally create or arrive at novel ideas through this integration of different areas of knowledge. And it specifically emerges from this sense of this synthesis of this holism that ultimately emerges from everything being encompassed by divinity and by this sense of unity. So take a look in source four. The real answer, he's talking about the idea of synthesis, and this is the real idea of the synthesis of which Yeshiva University speaks and for which it stands, is the qualitative accommodation of both studies. The secular studies are not inherently and eternally unholy, and the sacred studies are sterile unless they have something other than the sacred to act upon. And here's drawing from Rav Kook in particular. There is no blurring the distinctions between sacred and secular, but there is an appreciation of the function of the sacred in relation to the secular. The secular studies are important not despite the fact that they are not holy, but because this is the way in which all life, all knowledge, all existence is ultimately integrated into the great yichud of the Holy One in his Shechina. Eventually, all that is profane is to be found and sanctified through the Torah, for which reason, according to Rav Kook, is called the Kulaba, containing everything, is regarded as the fulfillment of God's blessing of Avraham's Bakol with everything, which if you take a look at the Ramban al HaTorah, he elaborates the Kabbalistic conception of this idea. Alder Chasod and Rabbi Lam is just giving us a kind of a layperson's explanation, which is certainly useful for me, that this notion of everything being included in this sense of this great tapestry. And indeed in Torah Umada itself, he privileges both Rav Kook and the Hasidic approach, which he sees as slightly different. He sees Rav Kook as this idea that the secular and the holy are ultimately cut from the same cloth. There's a distinction between them, and yet not a full identity. At the same time, he he attributes to Chassidus the notion of avodah b'gashmios, this notion that we are meant to uplift the physical through the spiritual. He writes as follows. He talks about worship through corporeality. The concept of avodah b'gashmios is that God's immanence in all creation and nature as well as in Torah means that the mundane physical order represents a legitimate avenue of approach to God. An oft-quoted source for this theory is to be found in Midrash Talpiot, to the effect that the biblical Enoch was a cobbler, and over every stitch he would recite the words, "Blessed is the name of the glorious kingdom forever and ever." This is the idea that all of the world is inspired infused with this sense of divinity. And this theory of Torah Umada was his favorite. And that's clear from the structure of Torah Umada. He places the Hasidic view last of the six models of Torah Umada that he presents. It's clear from the fact that he then compares and contrasts not only Rav Kook's view with that of the Hasidic view, but also the Hasidic view with all the previous views. And even though he wishes to maintain, in the spirit of Elu ve'Elu, a pluralistic Jewish community built of Torah Umada and also Torah only, but especially Torah Umada that itself can be based on a whole host of different models and different conceptual foundations, ultimately, it was this Hasidic idea rooted in monism for moderns in the sense of Torah Umada that was clearly his favorite. And he said so explicitly in an interview, it was published in 1990, the last one, there was this Hasidic view of the six presented in Torah Umada is really the one that's my darling. And that's his favorite. That's the one that he really loved. And so in terms of learning, first of all, in terms of the content, there's Torah Umada, which flows from this sense of unity. But it's not just the content, it's also the method. It's also the method. In Torah Umada, Rabbi Lam struggles with the question, okay, if Torah and Umada both ultimately emerge from that which is spiritual, that which is holy, if each one has an important place, even as Torah obviously ultimately occupies the most prominent place in our worship of God, in our Avodat Hashem, he asked the question of method. How are these to be integrated? In various places, he goes back and forth on this question, and I think it's a very interesting issue for him over the course of his career. But at one place in Torah Umada, he's actually quite unequivocal on this issue, page 85, source 7. And he writes, as long as halachic Jews persist in isolating halacha from integration into hashkafa, a larger theoretical framework or anshram, it runs the risk of becoming a form of religious behaviorism, in inadequate relevance to the perennial problems of the human spirit, advocating here for a more integrated approach to learning halacha and hashkafa as one. And this is very much in the spirit of halachos v'halichos. And some of these texts are a little bit on the smaller side. If you're looking on the screen share, I'm sharing it in a little bit larger form. But here in Halachos V'Halichos, which is a collection of ostensibly halachic analyses, and they are exactly that, chock full of lundos, which he took from his grandfather in parts, Rabbi Baumel, from the Rav, their traditions, and then he comes up with, of course, his own chidushim, and those are the ones that are presented here in a collection. Ultimately, he entitles the book Halachos V'Halichos because he says in the introduction, which is a crucial essay, I think, in its own right, which is worthy of being, I think, translated and explored in real depth. Rabbi Lam writes that ultimately he entitles the book Halachos V'Halichos because they are ultimately one, because the greatest way to understand Judaism holistically is to draw those connections between the halachos on the one hand, the halichos, the agadah, on the other hand. And he actually says that that if we don't do that, we end up again with the same terminology used earlier, with the alma de peruta, with the world of disintegration. And he writes at the bottom of page 12 of that introduction, that mashal mahadavar doma, to what is this comparable, le'ither zeh, to a blind individual, shemen mashmish v'anafim, whose strength is grasping for these branches, anafim arbeh, he doesn't realize that ultimately they are all rooted in the same source. And he later goes on to say that this is really the ideal. Hatov shebekulam, he writes on page 13, he says, Misha nichnas leprozer v'sampanav, the traplin, Misha shapiyan atamadu mechov schen, so yabeshes olam ha'alichos, someone who looks to the Yama Talmud and introduces and organically integrates it with the world of Agadah. Mishime achid is a dalet amos. In the kol ha'olam kulo, someone who incorporates all of these together in a beautiful way, and thus expands from just the dalet amos of halacha to be nevi gula la'olam, to kol ha'olam kulo, and indeed, in a quintessential way, as only Rabbi Lam can quote, with all the resonances that it carries, ki omnam, he concludes, kol ha'osik ba'torah l'shma, anyone who engages in Torah for its own sake, kol ha'olam kedai hulo, the entire world is worthy to him. V'achin, and indeed, says Rabbi Lam, kol ha'shana alachot b'chol yom, muvtach lo shu ben olam haba, such an individual is worthy of a share in the world to come, because he or she has now fused, has integrated these different branches that might have different nuances and different shades that differentiate them, but ultimately they're all rooted in the same source, and that source is ultimately the living organic presence of the Almighty in his Torah in our lives. So in terms of learning, both in terms of Torah Umada, as well as in terms of the methodology as well. Sorry about that. I'm just seeing
so,
that.
So maybe I think people want to see a little bit of you as you're talking. So maybe take a break from doing the screen share so that we can look at you as you talk.
Sorry, I thought I had it set as you could see me alongside the screen share, but I guess not. I apologize for that. I'm still here. Okay, so you know what? I'll leave it off and I'll just assume that everyone can follow on the link that I share. What I want to do now is to, in the last few minutes that we have, is to turn from the question of how this notion of monism for moderns influence not just the substance of our learning, the content, the Torah Umada, as well as the method, the sense of integration of an integrated approach to Talmud Torah, but also in terms of how we're meant to live. And here I want to briefly examine and review two themes. The first one is that of shilemut. This is, I think, fascinating in light of what we've said. The sense of being a holistic, well-rounded human being. This notion of a Renaissance man or a Renaissance woman, but not just in terms of intellectual capacity, but also in terms of our character, in terms of a truly balanced and multifaceted personality that is able to balance different conflicting tendencies. It's fascinating because on the one hand, when I think about it, I don't necessarily hear the word or term shleimut so much. I didn't hear about it so much in my childhood, this notion that this is an ideal. And I think that's precisely because we live in this almost disintegrated age, in this atomized era. And yet for Rabbi Lam, the ideal of shleimut is one that he truly champions again and again. If you take a look, you'll see in the next source, actually comes from Torah Umada, and he actually champions this idea. And this is, he actually says, and you can see, he says, this is indeed a hint of what Torah Umada can mean, especially if it is structured on the basic of the Hasidic model. And here is a beautiful peroration. I'm not going to even attempt it now, but it's gorgeous. Please read the words on your own in that paragraph, and then the next paragraph. In a word, the purpose of marshaling all areas of experience, of using all one's talents toward the sacred goal, is the attempt to achieve shleimut. That is the ultimate goal, and that's ultimately what Torah Umada is meant to foster for the broader one's intellectual horizons, the higher one's spiritual reach, and the deeper one's religious commitment, the more comprehensive and inclusive the domain one attributes to the Holy One, the closer one approaches the asymptomatic ideal of shlimut, of being tamim, of what he calls tamim tiyeh im Hashem Elokecha, on some understandings. This is shlimut with a wide angle instead of a zoom lens. Says Rabbi Lam, the ideal, and he goes back to the Maharal and many others, it's been lost. We don't have this anymore. But time and time again, we know that Rabbi Lamb insisted and he advocated for and he championed this notion of what he called passionate moderation. And he took tremendous heat for this. He insisted on the idea. At one point, he even changed the terminology, his preferred terminology, from modern orthodoxy to sensuous orthodoxy. He took a lot of flack for it. It sounded like it was sort of this a pshara or compromise view. It was kind of nish air. And so he ultimately went back to modern orthodoxy. But the idea of sensuous orthodoxy, and this is also the subject of one of the articles, I think Rabbi Sachs's article actually, in the collection, Jeffrey Sachs, is exactly this idea that modern humanity, that the modern world needs this sense of shlemut desperately because we live in a world of extremism. And of course, this has only been exacerbated in recent years. And here's, of course, writing decades and decades prior. But what's most, I think, remarkable here is that it's not just shlemut because it helps to address modern ills. It's shlemut because that is the whole notion of divinity. Our entire beings are somehow encompassed by God in this monistic cast, and we are therefore meant to embody this very idea, imitatio Dei. If God is shalem in that sense, so too are we. If we are encompassed by divinity, that is meant to be the glue that pulls us, that sticks everything together, and that brings together all these characteristics. Torah Amada is not meant to be this bifurcated personality. It's meant to be integrated. It's meant to be shalem. It's this ideal of shlemut that has been completely lost in the modern era, is exactly this sense of ma'aseh. We said Talmud of learning, but also of ma'aseh in the sense of the characteristics that we're meant to cultivate within ourselves and the ways we're meant to act within the world. And finally, the last element of ma'aseh that I'd like to speak to is a quality that when I think of Rabbi Lamb, I think both emerges from this sense of monism, but I think to me is one of the most stunning and personally inspiring elements of his personality. Rabbi Lamb was one of the most passionate, inspiring people that I've had the great privilege of spending any time with. Beyond the privilege, of course, to have even more of that time together with him, together with family members. And one of the most remarkable things that many have commented was that in a career, first as a pulpit rabbi, and then as president of a major university, at times where he was grappling with untold financial crises that were existential in scope and in depth, Nonetheless, you would talk to Rabbi Lamb, have a conversation with him, and he was simply present. And it's just remarkable. He'd be in the middle of resolving some major catastrophe, major crisis that had arisen, and he'd be up at some ungodly hour of the night, and he'd be responding to someone who just had a theological question, editing a grandchild's high school paper, essay, whatever it might be. Somehow he had it wasn't just that commitment to the family and to all of these at the same time. How did he find the peace of mind? How did we find, we all struggle with this, the sense of constant anxiety where we have, and then someone who had so much responsibility and carried so much on his shoulders to then carry this so lightly, it would seem, and this sense of equanimity, where did that come from? And he writes in a drasha on the next source, the ups and downs of life, taken from 1973, and he quotes again from Hasidism. It's exactly, it comes from this idea of monism. He says, Hasidism taught the principle of hishtavut, which might be best translated as holy indifference. This does not imply apathy to life. It does not mean not to care for others. It does not mean to achieve the maturity and stability for which we aspire by being less involved in our own egos and in our own welfares. Hishtavut is what makes man feel that he is not going to allow his inner life to be overly affected by good news or bad news, since God is everywhere, since monism, since melochal aretz kevodo, we must have quiet confidence in him. Too often people are artificially buoyed up by a casual compliment and feel inwardly devastated by the slightest word of criticism. Shtavut means hakol shavetzli, it's all the same to me. Since God is everywhere, a compliment cannot be greater than that good news, nor can a criticism do very much to destroy my serenity. And he goes on to quote from the Baal Shem Tov that this is the meaning of Shiviti Hashem Lenegdi Tamid, generally classically translated as I place God immediately before me, as this appears on many Aronot Kodesh. And instead, he quotes from the Besh that in fact this may be understood to mean as Shiviti, that I maintain my equality, my equanimity, precisely because Hashem Lenegdi Tamid, because I understood that whatever people would say about me, in the end, the only thing that mattered is being in the presence of God. And that was the most compelling, and that was the most important facet of my life. And so for Rabbi Lam, I want to suggest in closing that this theme of monism is not just a suggestion, not just an idea, but perhaps the central thread of his own thought, and perhaps even more than that, one that somehow he managed to imbibe to a point that I think is beyond many of us to that extent, and yet I think to me is at least this asymptotic aspiration to begin to strive for, which is this sense of Hashem Lenegdi Tamid and some sort of sense of equanimity that I can put aside the stresses and be there for that which is most important at the times when my presence is truly needed most of all. And he concludes the essay, just to come full circle, that original essay all the way back from 1961, again, quoting Rav Kook, just as Tova concluded. And he asks, what of the future we must again return to Rav Kook, in whose life and works are so magnificently combined substance and charm, power, and elegance, as some insight of the Kabbalist and the responsible thinking of the intellectual, the personification of the Yichud which he preached and for which he yearned. Bo Yavo, Rav Kook proclaims, it shall come. It must come. For the Jew who cannot by his nature bear disunity in his soul, it will appear in his people's redemption, the diaspora. The national realization of fragmentation, disunity is only ephemeral and basically unreal. Sooner or later, Israel should become one nation upon earth, and Yichud will come for all mankind. The future unification of all knowledge, all peoples, all existence is inevitable. Redemption for Israel and peace for all men will mark the world of unity, which is surely coming, which can be brought on even faster by our own efforts. And the Lord will be king over all the earth. On that day, the Lord will be one, and his name will be one. Thank you.
Thank you, Rabbi Sinensky, and thank you, Yoesed Halacha Warburg Sinensky. If people have questions, I'd encourage you to put them in the chat or to ask those questions through the Zoom now. As the moderator, I'm going to take some liberty and just ask a question both to Tova and to Tzvi. You both ended your presentations with Rav Kook, and that leaves a lacuna in the absence of the Rav and his vision of, you might say, the tensions, the Tzvei Dinim, the Adam 1 and Adam 2. And I'm wondering both in terms of the monism that Tzvi presented, but also in the solution that Tova presented for the seamless qualities of Chiddush that create a Torah unto themselves. Is there a conscious decision that Rabbi Lam made to leave behind, in some respects, the theology of his teacher, the Rav, in advocating and in some respects replacing some elements of that ongoing life tension in which pursuit of God is something which is not easy, that the Rav argued in Lonely Man of Faith and elsewhere for the ideology of Kook with which you both concluded?
Tova, do you want to start or should I start?
You can start.
Okay. Sure. Thank you, Rabbi Safa. It's a very thoughtful and a prodding question. I appreciate that very much. But I would say this as follows. I would say yes and no as a good a Jewish answer. What I mean is as follows. I think that Rabbi Lam did not mean to simplify Judaism at all in this respect, even as in certain regards he did adopt a little bit of a different theology that he embraced. And an ideal, I think the distinction is as follows. In terms of the end point, I think you're absolutely right. The Rav saw the end point as the ideal of this ongoing tension. That's how Uvi Kashta Misham, he presents it even in Halachic Man for certain, certainly in the footnote, that footnote 4 that you're referring to. And there's no question about that. And I don't think that Rabbi Lam sees the ideal human being as a torn and ruptured soul. I don't think that that's what he represents. I don't think that that was how he lived his own life or aspired toward. But at the same time, while the angle may have been quite different, I would nonetheless say that the journey has much in common. This notion of achieving unity is not just something that just happens like this. Certainly the equanimity that we spoke of is a life's work and is just really an ideal to strive for. And so to achieve this appreciation of Melochel Haaretz Kevodom lives in one's entire life with that awareness, to apply it to Torah Umada, to apply it to the way that we study Torah, to apply it to Hishtavut, to the sense of equanimity and to the sense of Shlimut, this is a life's work and this is filled with tensions, not tensions of kind of different competing value systems so much, but simply tensions within our own humanity, our own limitations. So that's what I think is ultimately is thriving. So I think ultimately it's a different ideal, but the journey will have much in common.
I would just add that I think that in other of my grandfather's writings, he does very much discuss tensions, and it doesn't always wrap up like a neat package. It happens to be that both of us presented ones where everything wraps up nicely. I would also add that in personal conversations with my grandfather, I think that, I remember him sharing, this philosophy of Rav Soloveitchik about the ups and downs of the religious experience. And even a number of times he cited the Chiddushei HaRim, who talks about this as well. So I think he did very much see this, agree with the Rav that this is a religious reality. I don't think it's as prominent in his thought as it is in the Rav's thought. And I also, a third point is just that I think that when his clientele was a shul of people, right? So he's talking to people and he needs to end his drashot in an uplifting, inspiring way. And I think when that's the case, I think that the way that we say things sometimes comes out or ends up a little bit differently. To end a drasha by saying just live with the tension, right? So that could be inspiring, but to hear that every week might not be. So I think that could also feed into sort of some of the ending messages that he has in his drashot. All the while, he agrees with the Rav Soloveitchik approach that this is kind of part and parcel of the religious experience. Again, we don't have the opportunity to ask him about this, but this is just my best guess here.
Yeah, if I may, I'm happy to leave for other questions, but just to add to what Tova was saying, although it could be that we're disagreeing, I don't know, we'll have to hash this out, Tova, give this out offline, but or online. But I would just add that that shleimut does not mean that everything always comes with equanimity. I think that's very clear. In many of his sermons, he talks about the ability to balance these different tensions. And I think in this, he actually very much approximates the ideas of Rav Lichtenstein in many ways. So that it's not that the inherent value or goal is to live that life of tension necessarily, although we can debate Rav Lichtenstein's theology for just a moment. But the point is that the ability to hold conflicting ideas in one's hands, to measure between them and to make judgments among them, I think was essential to his own approach to dealing with communal issues that arose and so many questions. And that was what he modeled for others. And I think, if I may, that's so much of what has been just terribly lost today. It's just completely, we live in a world where if you don't take one position or the other, you're dead because no one wants to pay attention to you and you're irrelevant. And truth to him was the ability to acknowledge conflicting considerations, and actually what meant to, and that was how you read the Rambam on the Golden Mean, and it's a whole separate discussion that's related, but I would add that as well.
Thank you. Other questions or comments? Okay, then we'll close and wish certainly Aliyah Neshama, that the ideas of Rabbi Lam continue to live on, and they remain something which are ever much alive in our communities, and things that we will continue to discuss, think, debate, and be inspired by for many, many years. And the opportunity to publish this volume and to continue and to spark new conversations about the life and legacy of Rabbi Lam is something which is a zechut for us all. And it's a zechut that we looked forward to continuing long into the future. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Tova. Thank you, Tzvi.